live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, in a sweeping and unprecedented move, the CDC is cutting the number of vaccines routinely recommended for all children nearly in half, narrowing long-standing guidance for shots against illnesses like flu, hepatitis, and meningitis, a change driven by an administration that has long questioned the role of childhood vaccines. We'll get reaction from Ulster County's public health director. New year, same story for FIMFO. No decision is imminent for the Highland Campground Project. And big bucks for rural health. New York and Pennsylvania get hundreds of millions of dollars. Liam Mayo from the River Reporter is here with details on both of those stories. And control of the Pennsylvania General Assembly up for grabs in 2026. Democrats and Republicans are gearing up for an expensive fight. We speak to Spotlight PA for more coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. defense officials say that the U.S. has seized two tanker ships. The Pentagon says one of them is a stateless motor tanker called the MT Sophia. The other is a Russian-flagged oil tanker originally called the Bella One. U.S. defense officials say that tanker has links to Venezuela. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the U.S. is still blockading Venezuelan oil worldwide. Now, Energy Secretary Chris Wright is giving more detail on how the Trump administration is going to use Venezuelan oil.
We're going to let the market, let the oil flow, sell that market to United States refineries and to around the world to bring better oil supplies, but have those sales done by the U.S. government and deposited into accounts controlled by the U.S. government. And then from there, those funds can flow back into Venezuela to benefit the Venezuelan people.
Energy Secretary Wright was speaking to a Goldman Sachs energy conference in Miami this morning. It's been a year since wildfires in Southern California left more than 30 people dead in and around Los Angeles and caused billions of dollars worth of damage. NPR's Liz Baker reports LA's new fire chief has announced a new independent investigation into the department's response to the blazes.
The Palisades fire, which killed 12 people, started after high winds stirred up the remains of another blaze the LA Fire Department believed they had extinguished 1 week earlier. In fact, it was still smoldering underground.
The outcome has made it incredibly clear that our mop-up and verification process needed to be stronger. We have to own that. And I do.
LA Fire Chief Jaime Moore, who was not in charge during the fires, says his department has made changes since, including use of thermal imaging and drones. He also announced a second independent investigation into the LAFD's response to both fires after acknowledging that the first report, which published before his tenure as chief, was heavily edited to shield department leadership from responsibility. Liz Baker, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as investors watch for signals on the U.S. job market. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped nearly 130 points in early trading.
The Labor Department reports today on job turnover in December. There's been relatively little churn in the labor market in recent months, as most people who have jobs are reluctant to give them up. We'll get the government's most complete report on employment and unemployment for December later this week. The board of directors of Warner Brothers is once again urging shareholders to reject a hostile takeover bid from Paramount, valued at close to $78 billion. Netflix has offered $72 billion for Warner Brothers streaming and studio business. The board is recommending shareholders take that offer. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 140 points. It's NPR. As the Trump administration withdraws hundreds of National Guard troops across the country, it's ramping up immigration efforts in Minneapolis. The Department of Homeland Security says it sent thousands of immigration agents into Minneapolis on an operation to target illegal immigration. President Trump has been saying, without providing evidence, that Somalis and Somali Americans who run daycares are defrauding taxpayers. The man accused of killing his parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner, will appear in court today in Los Angeles. Steve Futterman reports Nick Reiner will be arraigned.
He made his first court appearance on December 17th. Today, Nick Reiner is expected to enter a plea. Reiner is charged with two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, a charge that carries a maximum sentence of death. The case has received enormous publicity, but defense attorney Alan Jackson has asked that the process be allowed to run its course.
There are very, very complex and serious issues that are associated with this case. These need to be thoroughly but very carefully dealt with.
Nick Reiner has dealt with substance issues for many years. His attorney has not indicated whether or not he will use an insanity or diminished capacity defense. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Much of Europe continues to struggle with a huge winter storm. Airline and train passengers are running into delays because of snow and ice. About 1,000 airline passengers were stuck overnight in Amsterdam's airport because of the weather. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. In an unprecedented change, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reducing the number of vaccines routinely recommended for children from 17 to 11. On the new schedule, vaccines that had previously been recommended for all children, such as those for rotavirus, hepatitis A and B, meningitis, and seasonal flu, are now more restricted. They are recommended only for those at high risk or after consultation with a healthcare provider, a category called shared decision-making. I spoke with Ulster County's public health director, Dr. Eve Walter, yesterday for her reaction to the news and the potential impact of this decision on children's health.
Basically, the CDC has come out with revised guidance for childhood immunizations, reducing the number of vaccines, primarily reducing the number of vaccines. I think there are some things related to scheduling that they their language of explanation related to aligning more with other developed countries' vaccine schedules. So as a result, several of what were typically in the list of vaccines that were recommended and provided for babies and children were eliminated as such as RSV, influenza, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, several others, with the caveats of it being applied only with guidance or conversations between parents and doctors. So at this point, you know, we don't really know what the full implications of this announcement are in general, let alone in New York. It could, at an extreme, impact laws related to requirements for schools. Right now, the full scale of immunizations are required for school enrollment. We don't know if this will change. We don't know if this will change only in some states and not others. We don't know how New York State will respond. We do know that it was a while ago that there was a statement out by Kennedy against hepatitis B, and New York State did respond, emphasizing that it still supported the established regimen of immunizing babies with for hepatitis B. So how it responds to this, we are still waiting to see.
Many parents depend on clear guidance for their children's health. It sounds like there's going to be a lot of confusion here. What are some concerns you might have, or are you already hearing from folks and families about this and confusion they might have?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this will create and add to a lot of confusion and also just feed into potentially just questions of trust of the healthcare system. I think that it does, while there are messages that we're in departments of health making clear that we are in high season for RSV and influenza, that these are all all of these diseases are ones that we're quite concerned about, especially young children who are the most vulnerable. I mean, the highest and lowest end of the age spectrum are our most vulnerable population. So our newborns, infants, and our senior citizens. And so it's going to be challenging because I think it suggests that these are potentially harmful, which is inaccurate. And in fact, that's not ever stated in the revised guidelines, but because they're unharmful. But of course, why else in the mind of your average person, why wouldn't they think that it's because there's a concern? So I think it feeds into that, even though these have been in existence for a very long time and have been proven to be extremely safe and extremely important in reducing hospitalizations and deaths. So I think that's going to be a problem. I think that it'll impact sort of the capacity for schools and camps if the requirements of full immunizations change. It can impact how they operate. These schools and camps are particularly potentially breeding grounds for infections because these are where all children congregate, so which is why it's all the more important that, you know, children are immunized before going there. We are already seeing high rates of RSV and influenza and COVID. Influenza right now, it's all in the newspaper, those rates have been higher this year in hospitalizations than we've ever had before. And, you know, again, the youngest people are most vulnerable. I'll say we have we offer a clinic once a week for immunizations for families that are uninsured or underinsured. And this week, for the first time that I'm aware of, we had so many requests that we had to expand our clinic hours. And because people are very nervous, mostly influenza, but we also have a few from meningococcal immunizations. So, you know, people are feeling worried about what's out there, and then they're getting this message, and I think it's really problematic. I think what's also problematic is these other countries. Denmark is tiny compared to the United States. It has universal health care, so they have an easier time doing screenings. They have an easier time doing follow-ups. The parents are taking their kids more regularly to get the care. There's more touches when you have universal health care. Sometimes here in the United States, especially among individuals who are the most vulnerable, lowest income, struggling in other ways, homeless or housing insecure, sometimes at birth or in the first few months is health care's only opportunity to have access to these kids to make sure that they get the treatment they have. So it's an apples to oranges comparison to take a place like United States that does not have universal health care to a place as small as somewhere like Denmark that does. Our whole system is very, very different here. And we already have people falling through the cracks. You know, the interesting thing is, like, if you take Hep B, for example, the idea is that, well, if the mother tests negative for it, then maybe it's fine. But research has shown that a lot of these women have not gotten tested. There's false negatives. And so, you know, this is putting everybody at risk in larger public health. It's not even just putting the babies at risk, but a child can be asymptomatic for Hep A, and then they're in their home and grandma or grandpa come and it's spread to them. And so it's just a larger public health problem, and it's unfair to make a comparison with these countries that are much smaller and have universal health care.
Some vaccines, you mentioned flu, there are other vaccines that are no longer recommended universally, but under shared decision-making with clinicians. Do you think that's going to impact community vaccination rates or herd immunity for diseases like flu or even measles or pertussis or others?
Yeah, I mean, we already see it, right? I mean, we already see, like, fear and distrust of immunizations that are getting into social media and otherwise that are reducing. People are not getting immunized the way, you know, they really, we need them to. So I think that, one, it puts a really added burden on these providers. Let me just add, it requires also that these people are going to the providers. Like, we find that measles immunizations among that, when measles immunization rates of children under school age being immunized, we have certain areas that have very poor rates of measles immunization. But by the time the kid's five, those rates are, you know, upper 90% of kids are immunized, because they have to be, because for school or for camp, they have to have their full set of immunizations. But we see what happens is there are these parents who, from things that they've read or things they believe, have chosen not to get their children immunized for something like measles until they have to. It's unfortunate that that's the case, but that's what happens. And then we have these communities. I mean, we have counties. Luckily, our county has not had a confirmed measles rate, but we have counties right next to us that are, you know, increasing in the number of people who are contracting measles. And so, sadly, making this mandatory has helped really have a tremendous impact on us essentially eradicating so many of these diseases, and we're going to lose that criteria. Like, we had gotten to the criteria of eradicating measles, and you know, I believe it's no longer existing. Like, we don't have that criteria anymore. And I think it's because our larger healthcare system is such and designed in that way that it, you know, having things required are what unfortunately have a strong public health impact.
This change was sort of immediate without a lot of input from experts in infectious diseases or other public health experts. And being the public health director in Ulster County, I imagine you're still absorbing the news, but how do you communicate to parents and community members about what's going on and how they can feel informed and confident in their decisions around vaccination?
Yeah. So this is, you know, it's new to all of us, because a uniform messaging is so important. Fortunately, local health departments like mine have the partnership with the State Department of Health. They are amazing up there. You know, the head of the State Department of Health, Dr. McDonald, you know, we look to them for guidance and messaging. We also need to see how he is responding to it, because we're essentially the arms of the State Health Department here on a local level. So, you know, he can put in for example, when they changed the COVID recommendations, he basically created his form of a blanket prescription that overrode some of those elements. He basically kind of said, I will be the provider and say that it's okay to go to a pharmacy and get this. I mean, I'm very super simplifying it, but he has some capacity to make their own decisions for New York State. So I have to see, we have to see what New York State comes down to. I don't want to overly confuse the situation until I know what this exactly means. I honestly can say we don't know yet what this all means. We don't even know if this will stand. We don't even know if there'll be enough backlash that this turns around. You know, sometimes these are such big new pieces of news. I mean, we've been getting this regularly. You get this massive, like, oh my God, and then like 2 weeks later it turns around. Mm-hmm. I don't know what will happen. I don't know if it'll impact school and camp requirements. I don't know what New York State will do yet. So at this point, you know, we're available. We have our phone number for parents to call, any Department of Health, I'll just say, because you have a wider than my county reach, perhaps, that Department of Health, we all have nurses who are specialists in immunizations, that anyone who's listening who just is confused or has any questions can always call their local Department of Health. We do offer free immunizations for anyone who's uninsured or underinsured. And, you know, at this point, I think that, you know, we're encouraging people to trust the established system that has gone through peer review. And, you know, there's been a lot of effort and energy and research into the established criteria and guidelines we have right now, a lot. And then it's been field tested. Not only has a lot gone into deciding, but then it has been field tested, both in research but in real life, because these immunizations have been a part of the spectrum of what's been delivered. So we know what's, you know, their safety. So, you know, I would ask people to sort of hang tight, and we're doing our best to sort of figure out what this all, what are the implications and what we need to do to help support our community as this happens. I think we got to avoid being hyper-reactive to these kinds of very dramatic, unfounded and assessed by peers and you know, unreviewed kinds of decisions. We have to be very careful with them, and not just immediately react, but also, you know, see what we what these implications are going to be, so that we can make sure that we keep our community safe.
Before we go, I just wanted to ask you, what's the one message you want folks to hear about vaccines and child health in light of this surprising federal decision?
Right. So the immunizations that we have in place for children and newborns, children, adults, everyone, have absolutely been tested. They are safe. They are effective. They reduce hospitalizations. They reduce death. They are very, very important to the well-being of our entire community, especially those who are most vulnerable, which are our infants and babies, as well as our seniors. If anyone is finding themselves confused, lost, needing more guidance, please reach out to your local health department. Talk to one of the nurses there, and they will be happy to answer your questions, hear your concerns. And, you know, the motto that we have here in Ulster County Department of Health is, we're all in this together. So, you know, just know that you have a partner in your local health department.
That's Dr. Eve Walter, Ulster County Public Health Director. We've been talking about the recent federal decision to overhaul the childhood vaccine schedule and its impacts on children, parents, and the community. Dr. Walter, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And yesterday, after we spoke with Dr. Walter, the New York State Department of Health said childhood vaccine recommendations will remain unchanged despite the CDC update. State Health Commissioner Dr. James McDonald said in a statement Tuesday, quote, despite changes announced at the federal level, New York State's longstanding childhood vaccine requirements remain the same. There was no new science, safety data, or discovery presented by the federal government. New Yorkers can continue to be confident that vaccines offer the best protection from preventable childhood diseases, end quote. And in Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said on X that U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was trying to, quote, sow chaos and confusion among parents, end quote, but those changes would not affect Pennsylvania families. We'll take a break, and when we come back, big bucks for rural health and no new news on Camp Fimfos. Those are two stories that the River reporter Liam Mayo is covering, and we'll talk to him next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artists and makers in Palestine.
Hi, Ira Flato here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music in gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Wednesday night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York and Pennsylvania have collectively received over $400 million to support rural health care through the first year of funding from the Rural Health Transformation Fund. And as we begin the new year, the status of the Camp Fimfo development in the town of Highland remains unchanged, with town officials continuing to review the project and its potential environmental impacts. Those are two stories we're talking about with the River Reporter's Liam Mayo this morning. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
We'll get to the rural healthcare funding in a moment, but first, let's talk about Camp Fimfo. Of course, that's the historic Kittatinny Canoes campground in Highland that's slated to become Camp Fimfo, a resort-style campground with more than $40 million proposed in upgrades. That proposal has drawn opposition from local residents who say it would harm the area, and the Highland Planning Board required a final environmental impact statement outlining those potential impacts and mitigation measures. But that review is still underway 6 months later. So why the wait?
Yeah. So as you said, it's been about 6 months that the planning board has had this final environmental impact statement to review. It originally got it like late May, early June. It started workshops in June and has been reviewing it ever since. And I think part of the reason it's taking this long to review this document is it's just a big document. It's 400 plus pages of Camp Fimfo's both, you know, plans for its development and its own evaluation of, or the project team's own evaluation of, what kinds of impacts that development will have on the surrounding environment and the surrounding community, as well as a lot of pages of comments from the community about the community's concerns on those impacts and the changes or the responses from the project team to those concerns. So the way the process works is the applicant gets to sort of draft this final environmental impact statement, but ultimately it's the board who's going to adopt it. So it's the board that has to be confident in that language and ready to put the stamp of approval on that language. And it's a large document that takes a lot of time for review. The board took a couple of months to review it sort of with itself, with its own members and with members of local groups or local agencies, the Upper Delaware Council and the local representatives from the National Park Service. And then in the past couple of months, it's gone a little bit more quiet as the board has been contacting other local experts in the areas of noise, lighting, and traffic management to review those portions of the statement. The board still needs to get in touch with other experts to review the emergency evacuation procedures, according to the December minutes from the planning board. And because of all of this, you know, it's very much still ongoing. We asked the head of the planning board what kind of timeline they're looking at, and he said it's sort of too soon to tell. Check back again in like 2 months to see where we're at.
And we should note that planning board members volunteer their time, but the development team behind Fimfo has put significant financial and legal resources behind the project's success for them. So do you think the planning board is taking these actions just to make sure that, you know, it's a thorough review and also, you know, balancing out the fact that this is not a full-time thing for them?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think, you know, when there's a development of this size coming in, it's, you know, one of the biggest developments, I think, arguably in especially this half of Sullivan County. In 2024, when we spoke with, you know, a former chair of the planning board who'd also worked on the Fimfo project, he'd said that the project is, quote, probably the longest running application to any planning board in the county. And you know, it's just a big project. It's $40+ million of renovations. It's something that could majorly change the character of the area. And like you mentioned, local planning boards work on a volunteer basis, and they work on, you know, the efforts of local citizens stepping up. So I think you could see that the amount of time it's taking as the planning board just really, you know, doing its absolute best due diligence and taking all of the time it needs to make sure that if it approves this project, it has done so in the full confidence that every I has been crossed and every T has been dotted to ensure that every potential impact of the project is considered and every potential mitigation point is put in the plan.
And one of those actions that the board took to review this was a split 3-2 vote in September of 2023 that required an environmental impact statement, or EIS. That set up this current phase of review where we are. Now, that EIS is required in New York State for projects that will have an impact on surrounding environments, which you mentioned. But, you know, the FINFO team, because of their reserves, were able to write a draft EIS. So the board is now reviewing that. They're not rubber stamping it. What are they doing? They're looking for outside expert opinions.
Yeah, they're looking for outside expert opinions. They went over their own, like, in their own workshops, they went over their own the draft of it on their own and identified bits of the document that they were flagging for review. It's a lot of legalese, and I don't want to get sort of too far into the weeds, but one of the points, or I guess an illustrative point, is about the emergency management plan. So because it's this campsite on the river, there needs to be an evacuation plan for when flooding occurs, and that's sort of how that's going to go down is in the EIS. The National Park Service, as one of the local experts that's reviewing this project, sent a letter sort of for consideration, and one of the things the National Park Service pointed out was that as drafted, the evacuation plan as proposed relies heavily on sort of specific info from the Delaware River gauge at Berryville, but the National Park Service was concerned that if the evacuation plan was carried out as proposed in the plan, there wouldn't be enough time to properly evacuate everything from where it needs to be evacuation from. So the National Park Service recommended a couple of things for revision, including waiting or like starting evacuation earlier, so not waiting until flooding is actually actionable, like starting evacuation when flooding is forecasted. So it's that kind of thing where, like, if you take the time to fully review it, which takes a significant amount of time and expert opinion, but if you take the time to review it and do it now, you could save yourself a lot of headache and potential like injury or loss of life down the road. Like it's taking a really long time, especially compared to, I think, other projects in the county, but there is also just a lot to be taken into consideration, and the potential harms of getting it wrong are pretty significant and pretty severe.
You mentioned the National Park Service, one of the partners and sources of input along the river, and also that includes the Upper Delaware Council. There are a lot of organizations that are involved with the Delaware River, and those are two key ones. The UDC is that partnership of local and state federal governments with a stake in the health of the Upper Delaware. That's just that section of the river south of Hancock to just north of Port Jervis, about 73.5 miles. And both the UDC and the National Park Service maintain a river management plan, which lays out guidelines on how to balance historic uses of the Upper Delaware, such as camping in this case, with the preservation of the river's health. What are they saying in that, through that lens? I think the National Park Service believes the project to be incompatible, but the UDC previously approved the project as compatible.
Yeah, that was something I'd noted in the National Park Service's recent letter. A couple of years ago in the process, the UDC and the NPS both had to rule on whether the project was like conformed with the strictures of this river management plan, whether it was acceptable. And the UDC sort of went back and forth about it, but ultimately voted in a split vote that it was compatible. But that recommendation goes to the National Park Service for the review, and the National Park Service wrote at the time that it wasn't compatible. And one of the specific points, there were a couple of points, but one of the points they brought up was that the park model RVs that the project plans to use as essentially cabins, they're technically legally RVs, but they would function largely as cabins. They would be placed on the site. They wouldn't be, brought by individuals and backed in and out as regular camping RVs would be. But the National Park Service's position is that these are essentially permanent structures, and that permanent structures in the River Valley aren't allowed under the or in this kind of state aren't allowed under the river management plan. So that didn't really result in anything at the time. And it's, I'm unsure sort of where that stands exactly in terms of what it could result in. But the National Park Service did reiterate in its recent letter that its position remains unchanged, that the river management plan prohibits permanent structures at campsites, and that these park model RVs are, in according to the National Park Service, permanent structures. It also is maintaining that it sort of still believes that the project would substantially alter the intensity of the existing site. This is something that, you know, project advocates and project detractors have been arguing back and forth over the years. People in support of this project and the developers are saying, well, we're taking a campsite and we're keeping it as a campsite. We're just modernizing it. And like, this is what camping looks like now. It is these sort of more permanent structures. It's not, you know, you pull up to a barren campsite and you pitch your own tent and you sleep out under the stars getting dirt in your mouth. Like that model of camping isn't really what camping looks like in the modern day and age. It is this version of camping that has a little more amenities. So the project team has been arguing it's not really changing the use of the site. Advocates have been saying, like, no, you are changing the use of the site. And the National Park Service in that letter was maintaining that, quote, the camp would substantially alter the intensity of the existing, primarily primitive tent camping facility in a manner that is incompatible with the traditional character of the area. So it's not really like a new development that the National Park Service is putting this out, but it is sort of restating those battle lines.
Well, restating this as we look to the new year to see if anything moves on this, and I know you'll be keeping an eye on it. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Liam Mayo from The River Reporter about two big stories he is keeping an eye on. The latest on Camp FIMFO. It's a new year, but it's the same story for Camp FIMFO. The other story we want to get to is big bucks for rural health. New York and Pennsylvania received hundreds of millions of dollars from the Rural Health Transformation Fund. That was the fund that was established as part of garnering support from legislators as they were passing the Big Beautiful Bill, so-called, to allay concerns of Medicaid cuts. So they cut about $1 trillion from the Medicaid program nationally, but then put $50 billion into a rural health transformation fund. What did New York get? What did Pennsylvania get? And how will it be used?
Yeah. As you mentioned, the idea behind the Rural Health Transformation Fund is that these Medicaid cuts would have an outsized impact on healthcare in rural areas. So you need to put some money back into rural healthcare to support it. This is a 5-year program with $10 billion being available each year. This year, it was announced that New York State will receive $212 million. Pennsylvania will receive $193 million, both of those in sort of that first year funding from the program.
Mm-hmm. And then, it remains to be seen whether or not this is going to fill that bigger gap from the Medicare funding that was stripped. But what are legislators and officials saying about this in New York and Pennsylvania?
Yeah, officials are saying this will sort of strengthen rural health care. They're saying that from both across New York and Pennsylvania. Our local representative, Rob Bresnahan, in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania's 8th district, who has been kind of a from-the-start advocate for this Rural Health Transformation Fund, called it a major win for Pennsylvania's rural communities, saying that he knows how critical these resources will be for our hospital providers and patients. And the immediate details on Pennsylvania's plan were, or sorry, New York's plan, weren't immediately available, but, I reviewed some of the Pennsylvania's details for how it would like to use this money. And it fell into, or there were a couple of major pillars to it. A lot of what is in the plan talks about regionalization of healthcare or providing more resources at the regional level. It wants to put together these rural care collectives, which would be big regional roundtables bringing together health care providers, other stakeholders from local governments, businesses, educators, et cetera, and to have those rural collectives be what sort of decides where the money and where the resources go from this fund and how that influences things on the local and regional level. It also really wants to focus on boosting the rural healthcare workforce and wants to do that in a couple of ways. It wants to focus on recruiting and training rural students with the idea that if you train someone from a rural area in medicine, that person has a connection to a rural area and would be more likely to go back to a rural area to practice medicine. It also wants to train doctors who come from anywhere to, or it wants to train doctors specifically in rural areas. So it wants to have more residencies in rural areas, sort of along the same principle. Mm-hmm. So even if, say, a doctor comes from an urban area, if they spend time in a rural area practicing medicine as part of their training, they might grow roots there, or they might just feel more comfortable committing to practicing healthcare in a rural area after their education or as part of their continuing education.
Well, and we'll hear from our local rural hospitals about that money when it trickles down. Liam Mayo from the River Reporter. You can read about these stories and more at riverreporter.com. Liam, thanks for joining us. Happy New Year.
Thank you for having me. Happy New Year yourself.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the race for control of Pennsylvania's General Assembly is already heating up. With key districts in play statewide, both parties are preparing for a costly 2026 showdown. We'll get more from Spotlight PA next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, migrating bald eagles return to the Upper Delaware River. We spend a morning at the Zane Grey Museum in Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania, learning what makes eagles so special.
I just find them so majestic, and to watch them glide, seems like nothing can stop them, so they're powerful.
That's this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Control of the Pennsylvania General Assembly will be on the ballot in 2026, setting up an expensive and far-reaching fight for the power to set policy in the Keystone State. Democrats and Republicans will each vie to maintain control of one legislative chamber while attempting to flip the other. Jason Dole spoke with Spotlight PA Stephen Caruso about the battleground districts and the fight ahead.
I think a lot of it just comes down to our legislature is the one who passes the laws that, can be enacted on anything from what is the tax rates, what is education policy, what's our election law going to be, what's our abortion laws, our gun laws, energy. And, right now we've had a split legislature for the past, it's going to be 4 years in November. The House is being controlled by Democrats, the Senate is being controlled by Republicans. They've struggled to compromise. There have been three straight late budgets, two of them particularly late. We're talking November, December. They're supposed to pass that by June 30th. Very few big issues have been tackled. I mean, they've funded education and they've, made sure that the trains keep running, barely. But, things like property taxes, our election laws, many holes that have been exploited in lawsuits, the issues when it comes to energy prices have been broadly unaddressed by major policy initiatives. So the pieces on the chessboard, as one top state senator said, are dictated by the voters, and that's going to dictate what eventually gets done. That's all on the line of 2026. Voters are going to decide who controls each chamber. The House has a one-vote Democratic majority. The Senate has a four-vote Republican majority. But all that could change in these elections. And I should add, too, the governor is also up, who signs the laws. Governor Josh Shapiro, he's been very popular. He just announced he's going to have $30 million cash on hand going into the year. So he's going to be a tough person to beat for Republicans, especially in a year that looks like will be pretty good for Democrats. But like all of these are pieces that could change depending on how voters go in 2026. And with divided government being so hard, if one party were to claim total control of government, it could open the door to some very vast changes to the Commonwealth that, I think are even like almost hard to really, it's hard to overemphasize how big those changes could be.
What are the dynamics between Democrats and Republicans in the state House and Senate races right now?
Yeah, so, like I said, Democrats have a one-vote majority in the House, 102 to 101. Republicans control the state Senate, 27 to 23. All seats of the House will be up for election. only half the even number of seats will be up in the Senate. However, that's enough to swing either chamber. Well, I'll start with the state Senate, because Republicans have had a majority there almost uninterrupted since the 1980s. And that's a chamber that Democrats have constantly said, we're going to flip, we're going to flip, we're going to flip, and haven't. But again, you know, hope springs eternal. This is the year that Democrats say could be the year. That was aided by them flipping a seat in historically red Lancaster County in a March special election, which was a huge upset. It shocked Harrisburg, which got them to the 23. And all Democrats really need to do is pick up two seats. That means they can't lose anything now, and then pick up two seats, and then the chamber will be 25-25. And if Governor Josh Shapiro wins re-election, his lieutenant governor, Austin Davis, will come along with him. And that means Democrats control the agenda. And that could be big, because if you control the agenda, you control what comes up for a vote. They couldn't pass bills about Republicans, but there's plenty of Republicans who stake their reputation as moderates who'd still be sitting in that building, including a Republican from Philadelphia, from Erie, from suburban Pittsburgh, who might get sweaty if votes on the minimum wage, if votes on abortion come up. And what does that mean for them? So basically, getting two seats will give Democrats a huge upper hand, because they'll control what comes up for a vote in the upper chamber. Then looking at the House, you know, Democrats have nursed this one vote majority for 4 years. They even kept it in 2024, despite having a candidate running in a district that Trump won roughly 70-30. And that majority is, they've passed a ton of far-reaching bills. They've passed transit funding, which is a big fight in Pennsylvania. They've passed bills to protect abortion access, like a constitutional amendment just last month. They passed stricter gun laws. They passed labor laws. They passed all sorts of things that usually get stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate. Now, Republicans are hoping they can maybe flip that chamber back. They held it for 12 years before the new maps brought this Democratic majority into being. But, you know, and there are going to be some members retiring. There's already one member from a very swingy district outside Pittsburgh who said she's not running again. Open seats are easier to flip. So I'm expecting a really rough and tumble back and forth with a lot of, you know, a lot of money being spent and some probably like pretty strong campaigns. But those will be all across the Commonwealth. We're talking from Pittsburgh to coal country to Scranton, the Poconos, all over the place. We'll probably see some really competitive races in the state House as, you know, Democrats help to defend their majority and Republicans see if they can get back that one seat they need.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about those battleground districts, but just it sounds like you're laying out some pretty clear ambitions for both Democrats and Republicans. What if they're each able to flip one of the chambers and you still have a divided legislature just with a different party running each chamber?
I mean, I think it would scramble, you know, who kind of calls the biggest shots. Obviously, the chamber that has a majority probably has more leverage in budget talks. But, you know, and I should be honest that, like, I think that what the Senate and the House, even when there is total control of the legislature by one party, Republicans, they're different institutions. They don't always play nice with each other, even when the same party runs things. I'm sure there'd be some cosmetic changes, but on like what issues are focused on. I mean, you know, if depending on where the leader of that chamber is from, but you know, it would probably leave us in a similar position of a standoff between the both parties. Like that would still be the top line takeaway. So, yeah, I mean, that would be one of the funniest results, if I'm being honest. So we'll see if that happens. But it feels unlikely, but I feel like I've said things are unlikely that happen, and time makes fools of us all.
I mean, Pennsylvania does have a history of unpredictable elections.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think it would probably take some really weird scandals or something that is really hard to predict for an outcome like that. You know, because Pennsylvania has unpredictable elections, but some of that's just because of like ticket splitting. It leads to things like, I would say like Josh Shapiro winning in 2016 for attorney general while Trump wins Pennsylvania. Trump winning while Democrats hold the state house, including like that member in that 70-30 district. You know, it usually, I don't like things usually happen in a way that's kind of makes sense. I struggle to think of like a scenario where enough people decide to vote out their Democratic state house members, but vote in their Senate Democrat. But like, again, it could happen. I think it's hard for me to imagine at this point of view right now.
To what extent are national issues, national politics impacting or might potentially impact what happens in the Commonwealth in 2026?
You know, all politics is local, but also national politics increasingly weighs on people's minds, I think, especially in this national media environment with polarization and whatnot. And those national politics kind of drive turnout. So when I mentioned earlier that half the reason Democrats feel optimistic about flipping the state Senate is they flip a seat in Lancaster County. That only happens because it was in March. It was one of Democrats' first opportunities to come out and vote against Republicans, against Trump, against Elon Musk and Doge, which is really active at the time. And they did it with gusto, and they flipped the seat. It also helps, I think, that the Republican there was unpopular. Again, there's always these local things that matter. But the top level of Democrats were more enthusiastic to go out and vote because they were so hopping mad is going to be a top level thing. And we saw that again in November of 2025 in our off-year statewide elections for Supreme Court. Democrats swept those despite a lot of money being spent, about $18 million and counting by my analysis. So, you know, I think that why that top level national politics matters is that it's going to motivate the average voter who maybe vaguely knows who their state rep is, maybe knows who the governor is. They probably know who the president is, and it's probably most likely that whatever's happening at the national level is going to dictate whether they go vote or don't. And I should say, historically in American politics, whichever party controls the presidency does poorly in a midterm. And that's usually particularly true for a second midterm, which is, would this, even though it wouldn't be, you know, consecutive terms, this is Trump's second midterm, President Trump's second midterm, that is.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Stephen Caruso, Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. Stephen, along those lines now, you mentioned the flipping that Lancaster County Senate seat. So I'm just wondering, let's talk a little bit about the battleground districts, what it looks like on the ground in the regional contests around the state. What are you looking at locally around the state?
I mean, it's fun because the Commonwealth is really varied. I think it's a pretty good slice of America in terms of big, diverse cities, more diversifying and wealthy suburbs, small cities, which, have a big immigrant populations, and then like farmland and deindustrializing towns. And just all of these represented Pennsylvania. And so all of these kind of become battlegrounds. In the state Senate, which is, I think going to attract a lot of attention, where you have some key seats in the Philadelphia suburbs, two Republican-held seats there, I think, are top of Democrats' target list. You also have seats in the Lehigh Valley, an area that like is a mix of city, suburbs, and farmlands. I think that's an area that also does also have two competitive seats. The Poconos, there's a Republican incumbent who I think just because that district at a national level is blue and blueing. The Poconos are also a region that you're starting to get New York City expats who go into there, maybe super commute in. I think Democrats have some eyes on. And then out west, you're going to have, and then in Lancaster County, you have that one Democratic seat, which I think Republicans are going to try really hard to get back. I mean, the main question is, like, can they in a year where Democratic turnout might be really good? And then out west, you're going to have seats where Democrats are going to have to defend themselves, in some of the suburbs that were held by Republicans as late as 2018, but they flipped. But, a lot of suburbs have moved heavily blue. Again, that's kind of like the broad state of play. A lot of the competitive state house maps are, or districts are kind of underneath, would say, are concurrent with a lot of those districts I mentioned, with a few exceptions, in some Western PA mill towns that still have a Democrat who's been holding out there for the whole Trump era. There'd be a lot of overlap. As a reporter, I'm going to probably, I'm crisscrossing the state to cover all these races, I'll be getting to see a slice of pretty much every part of America.
That just kind of reinforces, in my mind, the role that Pennsylvania's played in national politics. It's the bellwether of bellwether states, almost. I mean, it's what we're looking at when we look at big national elections, when you look at presidential elections. Pennsylvania's been the keystone state in the center of the arch.
Well, as a Pennsylvania political reporter, I probably should lean into that and say, absolutely, keep paying attention to my state. We're up there with all the other swing states. I think the main thing Pennsylvania is going for it is that it is the biggest prize in terms of electoral votes still. That could change. Demographics are constant. People constantly move. It makes it for some fascinating campaign season. Also infuriating, but, that's a separate conversation.
Well, yeah, and that's politics, and that's campaigning. Speaking of infuriating campaigns, let's talk about money in politics. You mentioned Governor Shapiro already touting pretty big war chest. What are you looking at in terms of money and within the state, but also outside donors influencing Pennsylvania races?
Yeah, so, you know, Governor Josh Shapiro running for a second term. He was first elected in 2022. He already had entered 2025 with $11 million in the bank, which was more than our previous governor, Tom Wolf, had at the same point. And now he enters 2026 with $30 million. That is, by a quick analysis I was able to find, is at least triple what Wolf and other former governor, Democratic Governor Ed Rendell had. The Shapiro campaign is claiming it set a record, and I don't really have any grounds to dispute that. Like record for a governor entering this. Shapiro has always been a strong fundraiser. The 2022 race set records, even most of it because of Shapiro. He's shown connections to big national donors in Silicon Valley and the tech industry in California, also folks in D.C., in Hollywood, in New York, all over the place. When the U.S. Cruz campaign finance reports, it's almost a rogue's gallery of like big Democratic institutional donors, the Soroses, whatnot. Also, obviously, a lot of the interest groups, unions, trial lawyers, Planned Parenthood, et cetera. All of them really flock to Shapiro. You know, part of that's, I think, you know, he's a very charismatic person. He puts a lot of effort into this. He spends millions on consultants and travel, even in off years, to go and round up those donors, to talk to them, to meet them where they are, to get money out of them. And, you know, it really shows. So Stacey Garrity, or I would say any Republicans, really going to have trouble because you do need money to win these races. I mean, you don't. Or I should say, money makes it a lot easier to win, you know. And Stacey Garrity, his likely GOP opponent, one of the only like two announced candidates, at least at this point, she has raised money in the past, but she's mostly been able to get a lot of support from Jeff Yass or PACs linked to him. He's Pennsylvania's wealthiest man. He made his money off of stock trading for Susquehanna International Group. Groups funded by Yass have provided a lion's share of Garrity's money when she's run won up an upset in 2020 and then won again in 2024 as an undercard to President Trump. So, you know, and she's shared donors from labor unions. The unions backed her in 2024. So, like, I wrote a story last year that was pointing out that, like, for, you know, for a lot of donors who've maybe given Garrity cash in the past, they're going to probably be forced to choose. Maybe they kick a little bit to Garrity, but, you know, the person who's the governor, you don't challenge them lightly.
It's only the first week of January here as we talk, and, you know, November 3rd's a long way away, and so I encourage you to pace yourself, stay hydrated, and you've given us a really good idea of what you'll be looking at and the landscape across the year and across the state as you look at election news. I'm just wondering if you can give us any insight into, in the near future, what you're reporting on in the Capitol, what you'll be looking into in the coming weeks.
Yeah, so, you know, I do really like to remind myself that the point of politics is to win elections and then govern. And speaking of governing, there will be a budget address coming from Governor Shapiro at the beginning of February. That'll be his announcement of his policy priorities and, you know, what he wants to spend and how he wants to focus his efforts that the legislature then sort of responds to in months of closed-door budget talks. They have been delayed many years. I think that, you know, there's going to be these dueling motives of, do we elongate this budget and use it for political points? With November, with so much on the line, or do we just get this thing done early so we can go home, raise money, run campaigns, and try to beat them fair and square? Probably be a mix of both. We'll see. One thing the governor's office has confirmed to me is that they're going to talk about housing in that address. Otherwise, kind of a big blank book. But, you know, there's just, as you said, there's a lot of time in November, and there's still some things that need to be done, you know, in terms of governing. And those will be my focus because, you know, that's the point of this thing.
We've been talking to Stephen Caruso, a Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. His work's up now at spotlightpa.org. And Stephen, thank you as always for breaking this down for us.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Jason Dole for that. We'll keep an eye on all the election coverage throughout the year. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill, though. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Country House Realty, a boutique brokerage specializing in the best of Sullivan County. Country House Realty, offering exceptional spaces in beautiful places. More at countryhouserealty.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. That winter weather advisory is expiring, but we might still see some rain and snow showers mixed this morning with little or no accumulation. It'll be breezy through this evening with low clouds, high 36 today, tonight's low 33. Tomorrow, warmer 42, sunshine mixing with clouds, and then some rain in the forecast for Friday through Saturday, highs around 40. On Point is next.